Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, this past weekend, we had the El Paso Comic-Con, and it was packed. And I was asked to do a presentation about the paranormal world that I enjoy delving into. Keep in mind that there are many, many things that actually come to pass and we don't hear anything about it. For example, the accepted history of El Paso was written in 1923 by Owen White. He wrote Out of the Desert, the Historical Romance of El Paso. It was a limited edition book, and the copy can be found in a used bookstore, which is the only place you're going to find it. It sells for hundreds of dollars. But even this literary giant concentrated on the accepted history, paying little or no attention to the more unusual aspects of El Paso's history. There are quite a number of lost and hidden treasures in the city, any one of which would set you up where you never had to work again. Additionally, El Paso has been a hotbed for UFOs. The 1897 airship mystery. Now, the current UFO craze really got going when a pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold saw several flying discs cross his flight path. New Mexico has long been considered to be the forefront of this mystery by most serious investigators, and such groups as the MUFON UFO Network is very active there. Legend even has it that there are underground alien bases hidden in the state, with the city of Dulce, New Mexico, being pointed out as a prime location. Now, I went to Dulce chasing Sasquatch, and I found that there really is an underground base there on Archuleta Mesa. Didn't see any aliens, but the stories I collected. I've got a video coming out before the year's out. Now, over the years, according to the tabloids and hundreds of books appearing on every bookshelf in the country, there have been numerous sightings, kidnappings, and other bizarre happenings laid at the doorstep of the mysterious aliens. Unfortunately, it would seem that poor El Paso's out of the way that even the space aliens avoid it. Or do they? El Paso's involvement with mysterious flying objects actually goes back to the 1800s, long predating the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting. In the month of April and May of 1897, something very unusual was going on in the state of Texas. 6 years before the Wright brothers would get their flying machine off the ground, a strange cigar-shaped flying object was seen from the Red River as far south as the Gulf of Mexico and as far west as the Rio Grande. Witnesses speculated the craft may have actually been a meteor or a star or a sign from God or even a visitor from some other planet. Or did an unknown genius solve the problem of flight? Or perhaps it was a hoax. Skeptics immediately, if it's something they don't agree with, claim it was a hoax. Evidence be damned. Now, these questions were never answered because after cruising around for 2 months, the airship sailed off into history, leaving an unsolved mystery behind. A mystery that even involved El Paso, where the mysterious vehicle spent some little time. April 15th, 1897, tax day. A man by the name of Robert Hitch said that he and his family saw a bright light north of El Paso traveling at a high rate of speed toward the northwest. Now, you need to remember at that time in history, there were no known aircraft of any type, or lighter-than-air balloons were a rarity. Certainly, they were used during the Civil War by both sides for reconnaissance. But they were tethered balloons. Certainly, nothing at this time made by man could fly at any rate of speed, much less a high rate. According to Mr. Hitch, several other local El Pasoans saw the light, and all were certain they'd been watching the mysterious airship that had been talked about in the news. Mr. Hitch went so far as to send his story to the Bloomington, Illinois Daily Dispatch, rather than the local papers, so he had immediately run afoul of local politics. The story was never mentioned in any local Texas paper since it had first been published in a Yankee paper. Such was the power of local politics that in that less than enlightened age, oh, wait a minute, same thing goes on today. You run afoul of the local powers that be, and you may as well fall off the face of the earth. The next involvement of El Paso in this mystery wasn't a direct one, but the pilot of this mysterious craft told others he came in contact with he'd been in El Paso, which does tend to confirm Mr. Hitch's story. Since all descriptions held that the pilot of that mysterious craft was a human being, how would one know that the person in line in front of him was, in some stores, really the one who was flying about the country causing chaos and confusion? Then there's the story told by Major Donahue, one of a group of domino players who had their game interrupted in Conroe, Texas, by this mysterious airship. He reported that three pilots he talked to were traveling to Conroe, El Paso, and New Orleans. They told him they had stopped in Conroe for dinner to break the monotony of flying about the countryside. After a nice dinner and some kibitzing of the strategy being employed in the domino game, according to Major Donahue, the three got back into their flying machine and flew off on their mysterious mission. Now, John Barkley of Rockland, Texas, reported the night of April 22, 1897, an oblong-shaped airship with a bright light and wings circled his farm and came in for a landing, naturally upsetting the farm dogs and not to mention causing confusion among Mr. and Mrs. Barkley. When Mr. Barkley and his trusty Winchester came out to meet the pilot, he found that young man was ordinary-looking, who assured him that he meant no harm by landing so close to the Barkley house. Pilot gave Mr. Barkley a $10 bill and asked him to run an errand and get him some lubricating oil and a couple of coal chisels and some bluestone. Barkley was able to get the oil and the chisels, but not the bluestone. On his return, the pilot thanked him, told him to keep the change, and he would one day return to take Mr. Barkley on a ride in the airship as repayment for his kindness. You know, one thing about Texas country folk, even today, you show up and you're more likely to be met by somebody with a Winchester than you are with somebody with a hand outstretched to shake your hand. And as usually happened in these instances, the pilot got back into the mysterious machine and flew off into the heavens. Mr. Barkley never got his ride. Now, at the time, El Paso was a mere stopover, but there have been other encounters much more definitive than the involvement with the mystery of 1897. These questions apparently have bothered others in El Paso. In 1974, the El Paso Herald Post ran an interesting story. The headline was, 1897 UFO in El Paso stirred up questions. Texas was astir last May with echoes of an 1897 air crash. Was it a UFO? Was an unearthly creature killed in the crash? Well, the investigation by the International UFO Bureau started in June of 1972. Dallas newspaper publicized the study last spring and drew some national attention. Now, Hayden Hughes, Bureau Director, has published a report concluding that what happened in Aurora, Texas in 1897 has not yet been determined. But evidence indicates that the people in and around Aurora were observing something which persons across the U.S. were also observing. Basically, what happened in Aurora is an airship hit the windmill on Judge Proctor's farm. And that began a night of excitement. Then there's another El Paso Herald Post story from October of 1973. There's no doubt that the UFOs continue to visit this city, but what are they doing? The headline was, Flying Object Makes Believer of El Paso. And it was incredible, the first time I ever saw anything like that, said an El Pasoan of his sighting of an unexplained light. Tony Dellinger was on Trans Mountain Road moving toward the mountain at about 2:15 a.m. when he saw toward the south a little object that started traveling toward the mountain. Took off, and at first I thought it was a plane, but it looked like it was going up the mountain and rose up and went completely out. Then I saw it again between the mountains and the Trans Mountain by the dam. Took off quickly, went up, and the light went out, and I couldn't see it anymore. He said the object was like a long strobe light and moved faster than any plane he knew anything about. He said from here it looked like a Boeing jet in size, and when it stopped in midair, he thought it might be Venus, but it was in the wrong place for Venus. Besides, the mountains was behind it from his line of view. Well, he managed to get a souvenir that was supposed to have fallen off the UFO. Now, keep in mind that those who say there couldn't possibly be UFOs, or like the folks that said that rocks couldn't fall from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky, talking about meteors. But in actuality, there are rocks in the sky. Now, in addition to UFOs in El Paso, you got flying saucers, space aliens, and channeled wise elders. Because a lot of people who delve in the realm of the supernatural, especially those who like to use Ouija boards, and there are a good many. I met quite a number when I was researching the book. They've always, whether intentionally or not, come up with interesting stories to be and continue to be the center of attention. But in El Paso, in addition to all this, there were a number of stories of buried treasure and lost civilizations that would have whetted the appetite of a boatload of adventurers. Now, I've been an amateur treasure hunter for, I don't know, 60 years, and own one of the top-of-the-line metal detectors currently on the market. And I've talked with many local treasure hunters, of whom there are more than a few. And I was disappointed to learn that, as far as they were aware, there was no lost or buried treasure in the immediate El Paso area. They all said if I wanted to go over to New Mexico or into the Big Bend country, there are lost treasures aplenty that men had searched for over the years. But none in El Paso. In fact, more than one member of the El Paso Prospectors Club told me emphatically there were no lost or buried treasures in this area. Well, in researching and writing my first El Paso book, The History and Mystery of El Paso del Norte, I discovered that, in fact, El Paso can claim to be the home of a number of lost treasures, some of which have roots solidly linked in history. Any one of the treasures I discovered were buried in or around El Paso, be enough to support the lucky finder to a ripe old age. And I've heard many rumors of lost treasures along the Rio Grande, but I was unable to find much information on that subject until I came across the story of the Rio Grande treasure. Now, this particular story came from a magazine called Treasure Tales of the Old West. It was printed in 1973. As with many treasure stories from the Southwest, the treasure, which may actually exist, is associated with a ghost who seems to be the guardian of the lost treasure. Hand in hand with many of these stories are superstitions that also work to protect the treasure from would-be finders. Now, the superstitious belief in the ghost of a dead priest that guards the treasure and hunt down anyone that takes it led two boys in the 1920s to walk away. Well, actually, they ran away from wealth that would have given their family a much better life. According to this story told by the widow of one of the finders, somewhere between Socorro and Cabello are the ruins of an old village, an old adobe church. During the early decades of the 1800s, there was a number of deserted communities to be found along the Rio Grande. Inside the ruined church in this particular community is supposed to be a treasure that would allow the lucky finder to become a member of the Addle Rich. According to the story, the two boys stepped cautiously over the fallen and rotting beams inside the crumbling walls of an old adobe church beside the Rio Grande. A rabbit they were chasing had scuttled through the gaping hole that once held heavy doors. Had seen it dive under the remains of an old viga near the former church altar. Now, they had heard stories from an old bootlegger about lost treasures and ghosts that haunt that community. See, back in the Depression era, a lot of families had to subsist on what little they could bring in and what animals they could hunt to supplement their meager meals. So in this particular case, the two boys were out hunting rabbits. And having run the rabbit to its lair, they couldn't let it get away. So they were shifting the rotting boards under the old viga when the older boy jerked back as though he'd uncovered a rattlesnake. He said, "We found it." And the younger boy, who was scared to be in the church to begin with, wanted to know what it was they found. He said, "It's really here, the old priest's treasure." But the treasure was there. They actually did find it. They could see several silver candlesticks, a golden chalice, small blocks of yellow and gray metal, and silver crosses attached to strings of beads. All of it nestled in the remains of church vestments. See, quite often, when these old adobe churches were built back in the 1800s, now this area was dominated by the Comanches, who were so fierce even the Apaches were afraid of them. So as the small communities began to grow, everything was built around the church. And when it looked like there might be an attack of some sort, everybody would take their valuables to the church and the priest would hide them. Well, the older boy whispered to his brother that it actually found it. And dreams sprang into his head of the better life that these valuables could do for his family. So they, since they had no way to take it with them at the moment, they covered it up. Then they ran as fast as they could and hid in a grove of cottonwoods on the riverbank. But in this era of superstition, they swore to each other they'd never tell anybody because they didn't want that any old priest haunting them. Well, the story of the boys had been told by the old bootlegger went back to the 1870s. In a raid, many of the villagers were killed, including the priest of the church. But before he was killed, the priest had managed to hide the Eucharistic vessels, gold and silver bars, and vestments belonging to the church, as well as valuables that the locals had brought to him. It was during the early 20s that the two boys found the church treasure. According to legend, the ghost of the priest murdered by Indians was said to haunt the crumbling ruins to frighten away anyone who might seek to take the hidden gold and silver valuables. The old man, who the boys believed had been a bootlegger who lived near the completely deserted remnants of the village, declared that he and his family had seen the ghost many times. Spirit of the long-dead priest, draped in long flowing robes, wandered in seeming sadness around the church and in the cemetery, according to the old man. On still mornings, he said the priest could be heard clearly intoning early mass. The man's wife and daughter confirmed the father's story. Well, this was the story that instilled awe and fear within the minds of the two boys after they accidentally discovered the treasure. They were afraid either to disturb it further or to reveal its location to anyone. The older boy, Clyde Simpson, grew up and became a father himself. The younger boy, Bob Simpson, married the sister of Clyde Simpson's wife. And many times they talked about the treasure, the stacks of yellow and gray metal under the candlesticks. As an adult, Clyde knew that what he had seen were bars of gold and silver. Well, Clyde recalled that while the family lived in San Marcial during the 20s, he and Bob and their older brother Glenn often went on camping and fishing trips along the Rio Grande. They'd go out several days at a time. One of these outings turned out to be the treasure trip, as he called it, when they came up on the deserted village with about 20 decaying houses. The only family they saw for miles around was that of the old man, whom they suspected of being a bootlegger, and who told them the frightening story of the murdered priest ghost that guards the church treasure. Clyde tried to go back once while still living in San Marcial. He was riding a rather wild horse on the trip, and when he got within sight of the crumbling walls of the church, the horse spooked, bolted, and began to buck. Clyde was thrown into a pile of rocks, injuring his back. He said later he was lucky that some folks across the river saw what happened. They came over and carried me miles to their house and took care of me until I was able to go home to San Marcial. Then my mother sent me to California to Bible school, and I never got back to that treasure. Well, in 1929, the Rio Grande went on a flooding rampage, destroying, washing away, or covering with sand and mud a number of river villages. The Simpson home in San Marcial, where the boy's father was employed by a railroad, was covered with silt. The family lost most of its belongings in the flood and left the area shortly after that. After Clyde became an ordained minister in Los Angeles, he planned to go back and hunt for the village and the treasure, but something always seemed to prevent the trip. 1940, Bob Simpson and his brother-in-law, who now resides in Grand Junction, Colorado, traveled down to Rio Grande in search of the village. Bob said, "We hunted along that river for miles, and what the roaring water had washed away, the conservation district had leveled and ditched with big machinery until we couldn't find a sign of that old village site." Clyde himself was making tentative plans to try once more to locate the cache he found as a young teenager when he suffered a heart attack and died in 1965. Well, that raises the interesting proposition that perhaps the treasure was cursed. Clyde never said if the old village was above or below San Marcial. Between Socorro and Cabello, Texas, along the Rio Grande River, in New Mexico. Lies a buried village with its buried church. And within the village, more secure than ever in its tomb of mud and silt, is a hidden treasure, the old church. Now that story, if it's true, is further proof that the El Paso area is one of many hidden secrets. It wouldn't be difficult for someone to get an old map of the area between Socorro and Cabello and see if there once existed an old village that was bulldozed in 1929 as part of a flood control program. The enterprising man who follows up on those secrets can become wealthy. And there's hundreds of other treasures known to the older residents of this area. I'm still collecting stories. Now, some of the stories told to me by the older members of the community, along with the King's Ransom and Lost Treasure, they reported the area around El Paso is also the home of El Muerto, the dead one. I was warned if he caught me out at night, he'd pull me onto his black stallion and take me on a ride to hell. Now, to the modern mind, of course, stories such as this aren't true. It's made up to scare little children. The story of El Muerto is a common Mexican folktale of a beheaded man who rides his horse through the desert. Sure, his rider carries his head either in his lap or hung on a rawhide thong from the saddle horn. But there's a story that was told by Dr. John West, a professor at the University of Texas in El Paso, of a man and his wife buying an old house on the outskirts of Anthony, Texas, which sits astride the Texas-New Mexico border. According to the story told by Dr. West, a married couple bought an old house just outside of Anthony. This is all too common in most communities. Each night, the man would go out drinking with his friends, leaving his wife at home. One night, home alone as usual, the woman heard a noise, and thinking it was her husband returning early, she stepped outside their house and saw a headless man wearing a black cape riding a black horse cross the wooden bridge near their home. Now, when her husband got home later, she told him what she'd seen, but like most people confronted with such a wild story, didn't believe her. In fact, he became angry at her, thinking that she was telling him the stories just to make him stay home and miss a night of drinking. So the next night, ignoring her pleas to stay home, he went out drinking with his friends again. When he finally got home, she once again told him she had seen the headless rider crossing the wooden bridge, and once again he didn't believe her, certain that she had made up the story to interfere with his pleasure. Finally, deciding to prove she'd made up the story, on the third night, the husband stayed home. He intended to sit and wait for the headless rider that he knew wouldn't appear, and in this way prove once and for all that she was lying to him. After a time, they both heard someone ride a horse under the wooden bridge and both rushed out of their house to see who was riding the horse. And there in the moonlight, in all its horror, was the headless rider wearing a black cape astride a huge black stallion exactly as described by the wife. Well, needless to say, the couple moved out of the house immediately. According to the story, no one's lived in that house since. Well, the interesting thing is that others in the county around Anthony have claimed to have encountered the headless horseman, thundering through the night astride of a huge, powerful black stallion, head tied to the saddle horn. Now, I might make mention that Anthony, though a small town, is actually in two states. The community sits astride the border between Texas and New Mexico, so that there's an Anthony, Texas, as well as an Anthony, New Mexico. And I've heard the story of El Muerto in both New Mexico as well as Texas. But interestingly enough, the stories of him having been seen are all located around the Anthony area. Now, according to what I've read, the story of El Muerto can also be found basically anywhere in West Texas or southeast New Mexico and in northern Chihuahua, Mexico. And even though most people tend to dismiss this somewhat bizarre tale of a headless rider as pure superstitious fiction, it seemed that there was an actual headless horseman who terrified the region at one time. The basis for the story of this Western version of the headless horseman was told by J. Frank Dobie, the Dean of Texas History, in his fascinating book, Tales of Old Time Texas. According to Mr. Dobie, sometime in the mid-1800s, not long after the Mexican War, a rider astride a fiery black stallion whose head was tied to a saddle horn was seen by a large number of people along the Neches River in southwest Texas. According to the descriptions given by those who saw this galloping apparition, the rider carried his head covered by a Mexican sombrero tied to the horn of his saddle. His clothing consisted of a serape over a buckskin jacket. His legs were encased in rawhide leggings, such as most of the vaqueros wore at that time. His horse was a fiery black stallion, wild and faster than anything else on 4 feet. And though many tried, no one was able to run down the thundering black steed. As you might guess, the rider spread fear and terror wherever he rode. Well, this headless rider kept no regular schedule. He and his thundering steed could be seen at any time of the day or night, but always riding in the distance. Many with fast horses tried to catch the ghostly rider, but it was commented by more than one person that neither the horse nor the rider ever seemed to tire, so they had to be supernatural. The rider never moved a muscle, was that rigid as if he was made of stone and had been placed on the back of his mighty horse. Whenever men came near, the mighty stallion would break into a gallop that no mortal horse could hope to match. Indians, Mexican vaqueros, and far-ranging sheep herders all trembled in terror whenever he rode the plains. A large number of deaths and disasters were alleged by the more superstitious to have been caused by this agent of the devil, for where he rode, something evil and terrible would soon happen. Many of the less superstitious frontiersmen tried to come up with an explanation for this mysterious figure, but none actually came close to guessing the secret of the headless horseman. As is usually the case with ghostly figures, the story began that continues to this day that El Muerto was the patron of ghostly guard at a lost mine of the abandoned Candelaria Mission that was located on the Neches River. According to the story, the headless horseman rode to protect the mine from those who would try to gain its riches for themselves. Adding to the legend of the riding dead man were the many stories told by men who chanced to meet the eternal rider that then fired their weapons at him, but their bullets passed right through him. And thus began the legend that bullets couldn't hurt the rider. He was immortal, a man who couldn't die, whispered many. Immortal or not, the thundering black stallion continued to gallop across the plain, and all gave way before that terrifying immortal riding dead man. But the vast majority of inhabitants in the area that he'd apparently claimed for his own were content to give the mysterious rider a wide berth. But the human being is a creature of great curiosity, prone to violence in the face of something that cannot be understood. Several hardened frontiersmen who claimed that they feared no one, to include the devil himself, decided they'd join forces and catch the rider and solve the mystery once and for all. Staking out a water hole the big stallion seemed to favor along the river, the frontiersmen hid and waited their chance. When the big stallion appeared, they shot the horse, killing him instantly. When they approached the dead horse and the motionless rider, they found that the headless rider was a dried-up, almost mummified body of a Mexican rider with bullet holes. The horse had been tied to the horse and saddled so tight that the rope had to be cut to free the body. The grinning skull, covered by a frayed sombrero, was tied to the saddle. Well, the mystery of the headless horseman had been solved. This raised a new mystery. Who was he and who tied him to the saddle? Well, according to J. Frank Dobie, the corpse was that of a former lieutenant in the Mexican army named Vidal. He deserted his own army and fought with the Texans against Santa Ana. After the Battle of San Jacinto, Vidal was unable to return to his home because of his treason. During a living, he turned to stealing horses in Texas and driving them across the border to sell them to those in Mexico who asked few questions. Soon he'd gathered a group of other horse thieves to assist him. One night, Vidal and his Confederates struck the ranches around San Antonio while most of the men were away dealing with a Comanche raid. Gathering a large herd of stolen horses from the lightly guarded ranches in the area, he and his men started the herd along the long trail to Mexico. Well, unluckily, Fidel and his associates, two ranchers, hadn't joined the rest chasing the Comanches. The two ranchers, one named Creed Taylor and the other named Flores, gave chase. They were joined along the way by Bigfoot Wallace, famous name in Texas history, by all accounts, a cold-blooded killer. The three come up with Vidal and his partners, killing several, including Vidal. Wallace came up with the idea to cut off Vidal's head and tie his body on one of the horses as a warning to other horse thieves. Then the horse was cut loose from the herd. Horses don't like the smell of fresh blood and naturally thundered away across the plains, trying to run from the death it sensed. Of course, that was impossible since the body was tied tightly to the saddle. Once the three accomplished this grisly task, they returned to San Antonio with the herd of stolen horses and thought no more about the headless horse thief. Unaware and uncaring regarding the world around him, the headless rider thundered into history. Of course, the frontiersman who killed the stallion solved the mystery and put an end to the travels of the dead rider. Or did they? The story told by Dr. West of the headless rider being seen in Anthony and many other stories that have been told since that time and being told since the stallion was shot and the body cut loose from the saddle. Apparently, El Moreto still rides. The mighty stallion now joined for all eternity in death with his rider. One side note of interest about El Moreto is that it has been said if one follows the headless rider, the mighty stallion will eventually lead the follower to buried treasure. Who can say what's true and what's not, but if one evening you should happen to see a thundering black stallion ridden by a headless figure, follow him. See if you found a treasure. Or perhaps just a hidden entrance to a fiery hell. You know, there are many stories in El Paso about mysteries that have never been solved. There's the story of the monk in the burrow that I was asked about several times this weekend. There have been a number of wrecks caused on Trans Mountain Road by people swerving to avoid a monk leading a burro. Now, that story goes back to the Pueblo Revolt when the Pueblo Indians drove the Spanish almost completely out of New Mexico. Those in El Paso were afraid that the rampaging Indians would come this far, so the mission, which was in Juarez, mined one of the biggest mines in the North American continent. It's called the Lost Padre Mine. And they covered up the mine so that the Indians wouldn't find it. And one or two of the brothers stayed behind as a guard. Well, one of the guards, the monk that leads the burro, his job was to take provisions up to those that were staying at the mine. And one evening he vanished en route. And now he walks Trans Mountain Road. Now, across the West, there have been many stories about the Lost Padre Mine. I've read stories in treasure hunting literature about this famous mine being found in the mountains outside of Los Angeles, California, or perhaps San Diego, or maybe it was Phoenix. Let's not forget the Oregon Mountains in New Mexico. Each of these areas is said to have been the location of a Lost Padre Mine worked by the Spanish. And in each instance, the searcher in that particular location is certain he's on the trail of the one and only Lost Padre Mine. And if the many treasure stories are to be believed, the lucky finder of the Lost Padre Mine will become wealthy beyond the dreams of Midas. Well, not to be left out, El Paso has its own story about the Lost Padre Mine. And there are many who believe the El Paso story is actually true. September 3rd, 1892, a story appeared discussing the fact that tourists who stop in El Paso on the way to the city of Mexico or California shouldn't fail to visit the ancient church in Juarez. Electric cars crossed the Rio Grande, the 32nd stop for the customs officer to walk through the cars. A pleasant episode. While the forms against smuggling are being complied with, the stranger has his choice of two methods of amusement. He can speculate on the ease with which he's evaded the laws of his country, or he can look innocently out the car window on the Mexicans bathing in all their naked splendor along the Rio Grande banks below. The old church on the square at Juarez is in every guidebook. It's the first introduction to ancient Mexico. It's been much written about. People from Maine to Oregon have dropped their nickels into the slot for the repair of the church. Not many became sufficiently well acquainted with the good padre to hear the story of the lost mine. Every locality where the precious metals have been found has its lost mine. El Paso County is no exception. Tradition links this particular lost mine with the ancient church. At the corner of the edifice to the left of the main entrance is a tower. Doors usually kept padlocked. Visitors are free to enter the church and look at the curiously joined wooden ceiling, the pulpit with the eccentric stair on one side, and the confessional wholly unlike those seen in Catholic churches in the U.S., and the Madonna-like face of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Even the great wooden cross on which is a ghastly form for the crucifixion procession once a year is exhibited. But the tower, the tower is closed. Those who are permitted by special favor to pass the door find a stairway of logs, the end of which overlap and form the axis of the circling steps without any other support. At the top of this freaking architecture, there's a small room that outlooks through the heavy walls. And from this tower, the way leads to the lost mine. The church itself is on an elevation. The tower gives a view of the flat tops of the one-story houses, and in the distance can be seen the Franklin Mountains, and there is the lost mine. According to the tradition, one must stand in a certain position and look through a certain window in the tower and in a line with certain natural landmarks. If the conditions are fully complied with, the vision will rest on the exact location of that lost mine. The question is, where is the place to stand? Which is the window? What are the landmarks? Even the priest doesn't know. By the tradition, this mine was worked before the Spanish conquest. Very rich. From it, the natives along the Rio Grande obtained the massive gold ornaments that they wore when the Spaniards came. In the early history of the church, many of these gold ornaments were laid upon the altar. There came a long and stubborn war with the conquerors. Incursions of Apaches and Comanches made the mountains unhealthy. Afterward, the Pueblo Rebellion engrossed the attention, and still later was the American invasion. Amid exciting scenes, the natives lost their mind. Their descendants have nothing except the tradition of the church tower and the window to guide them. And not one of them seems to care to look for the landmarks. Well, this article was the first upon which numerous articles were done. The problem with this particular story is it gives you just enough information to whet your appetite, but not enough information to accomplish anything. And now the cathedral has been built between the old mission, so the direct line of sight is blocked. Now, there was another story written by a young lady named Jessie Peterson that her brother and his friend found the Lost Padre Mine. Now, the brother, whose name was Horace, and a close friend of his, Henry Hammond, found the hiding place of the mine. Now, this was just prior to World War I. And having found the location, Henry Hammond, a strapping young man. Horace had tuberculosis. He was very ill. And it all started out with Henry wanting to get Horace out into the fresh air. Hopefully that would help him. But having found the location, Henry went down the mine shaft on a rope. And about halfway down, he looked down and said, "It looks like there's water in the base of the mine shaft. The floor is moving." And he had brought a lantern down with him to light the way. And finally, he got a good look at the bottom of the shaft, and it wasn't water. It was snakes. So he left the mine shaft. It was decided to go down and they would get gasoline and burn the snakes out, because that's one way to rid a mine of snakes is fire. Upon his return to his home, he found his draft notice. He went to he went off to war. Well, now, the last attempt they had to get into the mine, they invited his sister to go along. And she begged off, said, you know, she was tired. Now, Henry wound up going off to war, and Horace, who had sworn to Henry he would not tell anyone where the location of the mine was, faithfully waited on his friend to return, but he never came back. Horace's condition worsened, and he asked his sister to come over to his house, and he confessed to her that they had found the mine, told her about the snakes. Now, Henry died on the battlefields of France. Horace died in his bed. The sister was never able to find the mine, so it still sits there. Enough gold to set you up for life. Now there is another cave in the Franklin that's supposed to contain treasure. That story is called the Outlaw Cave of Slim. He led a group of bandits, and they stole anything that they could get their hands on. And unlike most bandit bands, instead of dividing everything up, they agreed to keep it all together until they were ready to retire. And then they would have plenty of money to live out the rest of their life. Well, they came upon an unusually large gold shipment that they stole. And Slim, who discovered he had tuberculosis, which was apparently quite endemic, ambushed and killed his companions. Hid the cave, And he was eventually wound up going into a sanitarium near El Paso. And he became friends with a Filipino scout who would come back injured and was also in the sanitarium. And as people like to do, Outlaw Slim bragged that he was a great outlaw and had this vast treasure. Well, seeing that the Filipino scout didn't believe him, Slim offered to take him to the cave. And there, hanging from the ceiling of the cave, were the skeletonized bodies of his three companions that he had murdered. Shortly after this expedition, Slim died. And the Filipino scout tried to retrace his steps, but couldn't find the cave. Somewhere up in the Franklins is a vast treasure waiting for someone to find it. Now, you know, another treasure. Now, the Lost Pioneer Mine is not the only source of sudden wealth in El Paso, waiting for somebody to find it. There is another treasure known as the Mount Franklin treasure, supposed to be hidden just east of the Asarco smelter on a flat top mesa in the foothills of the west side of Mount Franklin. According to the story, Fortunato Salaz was a young man born in a valley not far from El Paso. At the time of this story took place, he was living just north of El Paso at the settlement of La Esmeralda, the settlement for those who worked at the smelter, also known as Smelter Town. He wasn't living in the actual smelter village, as he wasn't employed by the smelter. Instead, he was living in a temporary camp a few hundred yards from the village, where the Southern Pacific Railroad was putting a bridge across Rio Grande. Fortunato was a member of the work gang whose duty was to dig with pick and shovel. Fresnos and horse-drawn scrapers moved the earth loosened by large plows, and the men did the finishing work with picks and shovels. After a long day of backbreaking work, as with any group of men cut off from the pleasures of home and family, the main amusement in the work camp was drinking and playing cards. And if Fortunato didn't drink and didn't know how or didn't want to play cards, so he'd usually try to find a quiet place within the camp where he could sleep undisturbed. However, on the weekends, when the rest of the crew would go into El Paso or Juarez for enjoyment, Fortunato would leave the immediate area to find a quiet place where he could enjoy some peace and quiet. Many times he'd walk further up toward Mount Franklin, where he could enjoy a view of the valley and be alone. One Sunday morning, he was walking along a trail that he believed led up the mountain. Came upon a small adobe house inhabited by an elderly gentleman. Well, as Fortunato visited him whenever he had time off from work, he and the elderly man became good friends. And finally, the old man told Fortunato that he had something he wanted to show him. Leading him up the mountain to a large flat rock, the old man asked Fortunato to help him move the rock that he wanted to show him something. Slipping shovels underneath each end of the rock, they tried to move it away from what appeared to be a deep hole. Just as if it seemed that they'd be successful, the handle of one of the shovels broke and the rock settled back into place. Had no alternative but to return on another day with more tools. As they descended the mountain, the old man told Fortunato that though he had worked all his life in the south, meaning Mexico, he'd always planned to return to this spot when he could no longer work. He always converted his earnings to gold coins he had placed in leather bags and dropped into the hole under the rock for safekeeping. You know, the old man had taken a liking to Fortunato, and having him with a family, he wanted Fortunato to have his money when he died. When the railroad bridge was finished, the old man wanted Fortunato to stay, but Fortunato wanted to see some of the world before he settled down, so he moved on. When he heard from the local priest that the old man had died, he returned to claim the money, but he couldn't find the rock. Somewhere on the trail up to Mount Franklin, the leather bags of gold coins are still buried underneath that large flat rock. Then, you know, this was the area Pancho Villa spent time in. In fact, I've got photographs showing that he actually worked at Masarco at one time. And whether or not he buried wealth in the El Paso area has long been disputed. There have been many stories that are well documented that during the Mexican Revolution, Villa, a strong man of Mexico, spent some time in and around El Paso. He's alleged to have attended dances and gone to the Paso del Norte Hotel for lunch and dinner on a fairly regular basis. There are even stories after his death, his body was exhumed and his head cut off from his body by soldiers of fortune who apparently went overly well-stocked in the brains department. You see, the story was that there was a $50,000 reward on his head. That was placed by the U.S. government after the attack on Columbus, New Mexico. So this bounty hunter who lived at the Hotel Paso del Norte said, well, I know where Villa's buried. I can get his head. So he went down to Villa's rancho. See, Villa was assassinated, he and his bodyguards. And his wife lived on the rancho. And when everyone went to Mass one Sunday, he dug up Villa's body, cut off the head, and brought it back up to El Paso. Sent a telegram to the U.S. Marshal saying, I have Villa's head, send money. And they responded, Villa dead, reward canceled. He sent another telegram, what do I do with the head? We don't care. Well, we're to the end of tonight's show, and I have got a whole lot more information about some of the treasure legends and hauntings of El Paso that we're going to talk about tomorrow night. So until tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly